It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Last week, the National Rifle Association tweeted that doctors should stay in their lane when it comes to gun control. Doctors responded en masse, arguing that gun violence in the United States is a critical public health issue. A doctor joins us to share his stance. The Morning Show reached out to the NRA on this issue, but they have so far not responded to our request. Do you think the medical community has a place in the gun control debate? Why or why not? What role should doctors, nurses, and researchers play when it comes to shaping gun policy? Are you a nurse or doctor? What's your opinion? What has your experience with gun-related injuries and deaths been? How has that shaped how you feel? Should doctors ask their patients about whether they have guns in the home, just like they ask whether you smoke and whether you wear a seatbelt in the car, or is that an invasion of privacy? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Join our conversation using that telephone number. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Justin Lowenthal is the co-chair of Doctors for America's National Gun Violence Prevention Working Group. He's a student at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Dr. Lowenthal, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What was your initial reaction to the National Rifle Association tweeting last week that doctors should stay in their lane when it comes to gun control?
You know, I would say that I was a little bit shocked by how brazen of a statement it was, but I confess that I'm no longer shocked by the responses that the NRA puts out about gun violence. And I think that's reflected by the level of response, the number, and the quality of the responses we saw on Twitter right after that statement.
The NRA's tweet was in response to a paper published by the American College of Physicians last month stating its position on gun policy. Tell us more about the ACP's policy recommendations.
Yeah, so the ACP has been putting out policy recommendations since at least 2014, and this set of recommendations that they put out last week was just an update to the previous recommendations. And it's really about gun safety. I want to emphasize that this is about risk prevention, firearm injury prevention, and not so much about gun restriction or gun control. But a lot of what the ACP put out was related to recommendations to physicians in having conversations with their patients. So they recommended that gun violence be first and foremost considered a public health issue, and considered that way both in terms of how we research it and study it, as well as in how we think about quote unquote treatments for gun violence in the communities and sort of nationwide.
It seems sometimes that the term gun violence is so broad that it doesn't have a lot of meaning. But when you use the term, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and you're exactly right. When we talk about gun violence, we're actually talking about a slew of different types of gun-related injury and gun-related crime. So we're talking everything from interpersonal homicide, so these are shootings between individuals. We're talking mass shootings, although mass shootings account for less than about 2% of overall deaths from gun violence. We're talking suicides, which is probably one of the number one or two causes of gun-related death in the United States. We're also talking about urban community violence. We're talking about domestic violence and guns used in domestic violence situations. There's a whole list of different types of gun violence, and related to that, a whole list of different types of potential solutions that we can think about. And I, you know, often when people see a proposed gun violence prevention measure, a gun control legislation, and say, that law would not have prevented this mass shooting or this incident, that's usually true. It's true that not every solution is going to solve every aspect of this problem. The problem is so diverse, and the solutions have to be diverse as well.
Speed limits don't prevent people from driving too fast, but we have them anyway. Do you agree with the ACP's recommendations?
I would say in general, yes, we do. I think our big emphasis is on doing the research. The federal government has been restricted from doing gun violence prevention research under language that is vague about what constitutes advocacy around gun violence research. And so our biggest emphasis is to restore and fund additional research into what causes gun violence, what factors are associated with prevention of gun violence, and what sort of laws, at least that we've seen at the state level, what sort of laws work and what sort of laws don't. Beyond that, we do know that some research has been done, usually with private funding. And, you know, a lot of the recommendations laid out in this position paper are based on very good data from states like Missouri and Connecticut and Indiana, all over the country, that suggest that certain measures are very effective. So things like extreme risk protection orders or domestic violence protection orders that allow people who have been convicted of certain crimes, including domestic violence, and people who are at risk in terms of mental health, to have mental health professionals or law enforcement be alerted, so that they may be prohibited from purchasing guns and in certain cases actually be forced to relinquish the guns that they have, at least temporarily. So that's one example. They lay out probably 10 or so different points in a lot of detail. And I think most or all of them are very well supported by evidence that we have.
Justin Lowenthal is the co-chair of Doctors for America's National Gun Violence Prevention Working Group. Why is gun control a public health issue? Why is this issue in the medical community's purview?
So I would say those are two different questions. So tackling the second, I think gun violence is in the medical community's purview because we see the back end of every aspect of gun violence. When we're talking about trauma surgeons who are actually operating on victims of gun violence and know firsthand the wounds and the types of tissue damage that are caused by certain ammunition and certain types of guns. We're talking about psychiatrists. We're talking about pediatricians who are looking after child safety. We're talking about OBGYNs who talk to pregnant women who have undergone trauma and are at risk for domestic violence. So this is, you know, we see the very diverse aspects of this. In terms of why we consider it in the realm of public health, you know, when we talk about the leading causes of death in the United States that are not related to things like chronic disease or cancer, you know, things like car accidents, things like, you know, risk from smoking, things like deaths from gun violence and deaths from opioid overdose, those are always things that we talk about how to prevent. And gun violence is the daily toll from gun violence is now on par with the daily toll from opioid overdose. And we talk about opioid overdose in the same way as a public health crisis because of the sheer amount of damage it does, both to the victims themselves and also the psychological trauma that's caused to families and communities with kind of ripple effects downstream on their health.
And Justin, Yeah, we have to get to a break here. Justin Lowenthal is co-chair of Doctors for America's National Gun Violence Prevention Working Group. He stays with us as our conversation continues. What do you think? Is gun violence a public health issue, and should it be researched like that? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Last week, the National Rifle Association tweeted that doctors should stay in their lane when it comes to gun control. Doctors responded en masse, arguing that gun violence in the U.S. is a critical public health issue. Justin Lowenthal is the co-chair of Doctors for America's National Gun Violence Prevention Working Group. He's a student at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And he's with us this morning to talk about this issue. By the way, we also reached out to the NRA. They have so far not responded to our request. What do you think? Do you think the medical community has a place in this discussion? Do you think that gun violence is a public health issue and should be researched that way? Or do you agree with the NRA and doctors should stay in their lane? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. What would addressing gun violence actually look like for doctors in a practical sense in working with patients, Dr. Lowenthal?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I think it varies a lot based on the type of doctor and the type of patient you're talking about. So pediatricians already ask families if there are guns in the home, if those guns are loaded. You could imagine pediatricians expanding those questions to the type of technology and the type of gun, the type of ammunition, and the type of safety measures being taken. In terms of addressing it more broadly, there are efforts in communities led by health professionals and others to intervene, especially in urban areas, to intervene and prevent gun violence in the first place. And these are well studied and well supported in places like Chicago and Baltimore, where I currently am. When we're talking about trauma surgeons, doing research would help trauma surgeons know the best ways to approach different types of wounds caused by different types of guns and ammunition. And so it would vary a lot, but there are just a lot of questions that we need answers to from a research standpoint in order to do better, to make sure that gun violence can be addressed.
Justin, you're in medical school. When did you start seeing gun violence as something that intersects with your career as a doctor?
It was actually my first week in medical school. We, during our first week, get tours of Baltimore City and hear from people in the community about their experience, both with the medical community and more generally in the city. And every single person we ran into had a story about a child or a family member who was a victim of gun violence or was impacted somehow by it. And I've seen on my surgical rotations, I've seen in my public health electives, in my psychiatry rotations, gun violence comes up in every single setting. And not just in the city, but in communities, in terms of youth suicide.
Since 1966, the Centers for Disease Control has had to avoid conducting research on gun violence because of the Dickey Amendment. The Dickey Amendment basically said that the CDC could conduct research on gun violence but could not promote gun control. The federal spending bill passed in March of this year included language indicating that the CDC could research ways to reduce gun violence, although the Dickey Amendment is still in effect. Do you think we've made a step in the right direction here?
I think it's a step in the right direction, but I think it's a very small step. And I think the Dickey Amendment language is still having sort of a freezing effect on research at the federal level. Even with the clarification and statements from the Health and Human Services Secretary, there is still a concern among many in the public health research community that even by doing the research, if one of the implications of the data is to suggest that an additional regulation on gun ownership would be helpful to prevent gun violence, just even suggesting that in research could be classified as or thought of as promoting gun control and then causing CDC's budget to be affected, causing researchers to be suppressed in various ways. So I think even with the language still in effect, we need to see it overturned, and we also need to actually have real appropriations of money at the federal level to make sure that this research gets done.
Justin Lowenthal is co-chair of Doctors for America's National Gun Violence Prevention Working Group. He's a student at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Justin, what are the most pressing questions, in your view, when it comes to gun violence research today?
So we've talked a little bit about suicide, but what we don't know is what are the most effective ways to prevent gun suicide, particularly among youth. We know that, at least logically, certain ways of locking up and storing guns in the home can make it more difficult. We know that certain interventions in school early on and detection of risk and mental health, but we don't know exactly which ones are effective and which ones aren't. And until we know that, we don't know where to put taxpayer money to help prevent gun suicide. Same thing with urban gun violence. We know some of these community-based programs work, but we don't know exactly how, and we don't know if various regulations on guns, gun buyback programs that are voluntary, gun technology that prevents the original other people from the original owner using guns, whether those technologies would actually be additionally helpful in reducing inner city gun violence. Safe storage methods, technology. So there are a lot of very diverse questions that we need to answer.
How does your group, Doctors for America's National Gun Violence Prevention Working Group, hope to address concerns about research?
So we work collaboratively. We talk with other health provider groups, physician societies, as well as groups in nursing, in social work, in mental health, making sure that we have, among the research that we do have, the best data and a set of policy recommendations that we feel are well supported and are politically viable. And we are often in conversation both at the national and state level with legislators who are supportive and who think that this research needs to be done. We talk often with the House leadership and the House of Representatives about each year in the spending bill, trying to get this language overturned and appropriations for money. And so we sort of take an all hands on deck approach to work together and make this happen.
What policy changes have you seen, particularly at the state level, that would be considered a step in the right direction, in your opinion?
So I think after the Parkland shooting and as a result of the activism driven by the youth from Parkland, Florida, I think we saw a variety of state-level changes that I think were steps in the right direction. So extreme risk protection orders, which I mentioned earlier, have been implemented in various states and shown to be very, very effective. Things like, obviously, bump stock bans in response to Las Vegas, but other types of restrictions on some of the most egregious, large-capacity magazines and high muzzle velocity semi-automatic assault rifles in certain states, such as Massachusetts, have been very effective. And then efforts around identifying youth suicide risk and preventing guns from falling into the hands of youths who are at risk for suicide. Because we know that if somebody has access to a gun, they're much more at risk for suicide. And if they don't have access to a gun, they're more likely to actually find treatment rather than find another way to commit suicide.
Are there things that we can do as lay people, not doctors or legislators, that might make our communities safer from gun violence?
I think the first thing you can do is talk to your know what the laws are in your state, and if you feel they are insufficient, talk to your local and state legislators. Tell them that you are supportive of this, because ultimately, who the legislators hear from will often be organizations such as the NRA who are promoting gun purchases and gun ownership. So they need to hear from you. They need to hear from lay people. In addition, I think talking to family members, talking to friends, being aware of people around you who may be suffering from mental health crises or who are in domestic violence type situations, know who owns guns in your home and in those around you, and just make yourself aware and be there for family and friends to help support them and make sure that guns don't fall into the hands of people who might be at risk for committing violence with them.
kind of looping back to where we started on this, what has been the reaction generally outside of the medical community and the immediate NRA community to kind of this Twitter incident, the whole stay in your lane thing? What's the reaction been like generally? Have doctors been getting support?
I think, at least in my experience and from talking to colleagues, it's been almost universally supportive. I think even if you are a gun owner who's an NRA member and very against certain types of gun control, I think it's very obvious to folks that doctors and medical professionals are intimately involved with caring for people who are victims of gun violence. And so it makes perfect sense to say that this actually is our lane. This is sort of our highway that we run down on a daily basis. And if anything, the NRA is invading on our lane and not the other way around.
Justin Lowenthal, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Justin Lowenthal is co-chair of Doctors for America's National Gun Violence Prevention Working Group and a student at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Coming up next, we consider who will be the leaders in the new Congress just elected. That's all ahead on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. With the election disappearing quickly in the rearview mirror, officials in Congress are deciding on leadership roles for the coming session. We're going to check in with a Politico reporter about who will lead the U.S. House Democrats and Republicans. Who would you like to lead the Democrats in the House? What about Republicans? What kind of leadership would you like to see from the major parties? What issues do you want them to focus on? Or does who leads within the majority and minorities not matter to you at all? And why would that be? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Bresnahan is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Politico. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
One of the leadership roles, of course, is, and the highest profile one, is Speaker of the House of Representatives. Representative Nancy Pelosi held that role the last time the Democrats were in the majority. She's also been the minority leader since 2011. What's her case for being the most qualified to hold this role again?
Well, Pelosi has been the Democratic leader for 16 years now. In her view, she is a master legislator. She is unparalleled at her ability to make deals with President Donald Trump and Republicans. There's nobody better suited for it. She brings together all the elements of the caucus. She's able to unite them together, and that is not an easy job. Democrats, House Democrats are a very diverse group. So in Pelosi's view, there's no one who can replace her. There's no one who can do what she can do, despite the fact that she's been there for so long already.
Well, wanting the job of Speaker of the House of Representatives, regardless of which party in power, is sort of like herding cats, I would think. Meanwhile, so those are the things in Nancy Pelosi's favor, but not everyone agrees. Who is opposing her? Why don't they think Pelosi should lead?
Well, exactly the reasons why she argues she's the only one who can do the job. Because of her experience, is the reason why there's a number of incumbents and Democratic candidates who won members-elect who say, you know, Pelosi's been there for too long. We need fresh blood here. Pelosi's 78. The Steny Hoyer, who will be the majority leader in the next Congress, is 79. Jim Clyburn from South Carolina, who will be who's in line to be the House Majority Whip, he's got a challenge, he's also 78. There's a number of, and they've all been in power for 16 years, and there's a number of Democrats who say, enough already. We won this new majority. Let's put new leadership in place. There's about a dozen members and members-elect, the incoming freshmen, who say they will vote against Pelosi for Speaker. Now, there's two votes. She has to win two votes. She has to win an internal vote among House Democrats. And the position as Speaker, it's the only one She has to win a vote on the House floor, and that takes place on the first day of the next Congress. And that's when they say they will vote against her, which is a huge, that's a huge deal. It's like declaring war on Pelosi. So if they say if there are enough members deny her a majority on the House floor in a roll call vote, they call out their names, it takes like 2 hours, then she can't be speaker, and then the Democrats would have to pick a new speaker. So, you know, there's a dispute going on. Pelosi is, you know, acting like she's going to be the speaker, but she's got a lot of convincing to do.
Well, and Republicans kind of made Nancy Pelosi one of their campaign talking points. And even in this most recent election, don't vote for the Democrats because we'll get Pelosi again. What was up with that? And is that a factor in some people's opposition?
Absolutely. This was an issue. There's a number of candidates who won swing districts who say they won't vote for Pelosi because of this. Abigail Spanberger, who won a swing district in Virginia, a former CIA officer, she says she won't vote for Pelosi. Max Rose in New York, he won Staten Island. He defeated a Republican incumbent. Another one who says that he won't vote for Pelosi. This is a swing district in New York City, and it was the last district held by any Republican in New York, in the New York City area. So, I mean, she's got a problem with some of the freshmen, and then there's a number of Democratic incumbents who feel the same way, that Pelosi has been a problem for them in their races. Now, Pelosi's argument is this. Look, in 2010, when Republicans, you know, when the Tea Party movement was born and Republicans won the House in a huge victory because of Obamacare, because of the controversy of Obamacare, Republicans spent $75 million demonizing Pelosi. Now, again, they did it again this year, but in this case, the Democrats are going to win anywhere between 35 and 40 seats. So Pelosi's argument is pretty strong, saying, look, Republicans ran on this argument that I was a problem. We won, you know, 35, 40 seats. We won the majority. I'm not the issue. The issue is President Donald Trump, and what are we going to do about the country after 2 years of Trump being, you know, sitting in the Oval Office? So, you know, there's both sides to this coin, but, you know, there's a lot of internal discussion going among Democrats, and that starts today. They start meeting today internally to try to pick their leadership for the next Congress. But the process is going to play out for over 6 weeks.
Is gender a part of this conversation?
Well, if you ask Pelosi, it is, and her supporters. They're saying, look, a wave of support from women is the reason why Democrats are in the majority in the House now. If you look at the results of the election, women made the difference, especially younger women. And then the class that's coming to Congress, the new class, is a huge representation of women in this class. It's not finalized yet, but there's a lot of women in the incoming freshman class. So how could you take the first female speaker, the first woman to be speaker in the history of Congress, and turn her out of office now that she's won the majority? And so there is an argument. Though opponents say this is not about class at all, or gender at all. This is about, you know, you've been in power for 16 years. You've had your shot. It's time for new people to get in there.
John Bresnahan is Capitol Bureau Chief for Politico. We're talking about the new Congress and what its leadership will look like. What are we hearing about so far in terms of issues the Democrats hope to pursue in the majority?
Well, there's a number of issues in terms of there's a number of Trump-related issues that they want to pursue, everything from his taxes, his tax returns, to his, you know, the firing of FBI Director Jim Comey, to the Russia investigation. They want to pursue that. Now, on the policy side, they have a huge number of issues they want to pursue. Health care being the top issue for them. They want to pass legislation to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, to stabilize it after attacks from Republicans for years. They want to do something on drug pricing. They want to do something on cost of health insurance. They look at Medicaid expansion and what that has meant for states that have adopted it and where states haven't adopted it. So they have a lot of issues on that front. They want to look at infrastructure spending. This is something where they think they could get a deal with Trump and Republicans. There's a huge need for infrastructure spending in this country, the roads, highways, bridges, airports. They really need work. The Democrats have floated a $1 trillion package, 10-year package on infrastructure spending. They think they can do a deal with Senate Republicans and Trump. And then another issue for them is a huge issue is just, you know, is good government. They want to pass campaign finance legislation. They want to limit the amount of money you can put into elections. They want to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, which has expired under Republicans and has never been reauthorized. And they want to put new ethics rules in place for members of Congress. So they have kind of three tiers they want to do. They definitely want to push investigations of the Trump administration. Good, sound oversight, they say, of the Trump administration, which is necessary. They're not declaring war on Trump, but they want to do the job. Congress should be a check on the power of the executive branch. And then they want to push infrastructure and healthcare legislation, and then they also want to do good government initiatives.
You mentioned that one of the other leadership roles, House Majority Whip, was being contested right now. What's going on there, and who's challenging?
Well, Jim Clyburn, who was the House Majority Whip in the last Democratic majority, he is he's an African American Democrat. He is the top African American lawmaker in Congress. He wants to return to that spot. Diana DeGette of Colorado is challenging him for that. Clyburn will probably win that, but you know, DeGette is making the same argument that some of the anti-Pelosi forces have made. You know, Clyburn has been in this office for a long time. He's been the number three Democrat for a long time, 16 years. He's a good man, but he's had his chance. It's time for fresh blood and new ideas and new perspectives in this job. She's been a member of the Whip organization for years. She's very big on women's health issues. That's an issue she's pushed repeatedly as a member of Congress. She's a pretty smart member. She's a real well-spoken and very eloquent woman. And so she's trying to round up support. I think it's an uphill challenge. I think Clyburn will get it. He will have the backing of the Congressional Black Caucus, which is a very important faction within the House Democrats. They're actually growing. There are going to be more than 50 African-American lawmakers in the next Congress, which is a record number, and he'll have that support. And, you know, when you're in leadership for a long time, you do a lot of favors, you do a lot of you take on a lot of tasks for members. They ask you to do things, so you know you've got a lot of chits that you can cash in. So in other words,
you accumulate a lot of political capital.
They do get it. For the longer they've been there, they've got a lot more friends.
John Bresnahan, Capital Bureau Chief for Politico. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we're going to turn our attention to what's happening with the leadership within the state legislature here in Wisconsin. That's coming up next on The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Wisconsin legislative leaders met this week to talk about who's doing what and consider next steps. Here's what I want. I want to know what you want leaders within the Wisconsin legislature to know about what to pursue. What's the top issue for you in this upcoming session? What would you say to them about working together with people on the other side of the aisle? Or is that not a priority? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jesse Apoyan covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
The Wisconsin Assembly met this week to elect their leadership. As they discussed the future, what did they say about their hopes for the coming legislative session? Is there some kind of sense of where we'll see a focused effort?
Well, you know, it's worth noting that while Democrats swept statewide executive offices, the Assembly and the Senate are both led by pretty strong Republican majorities. And so what we're hearing from the leaders in both chambers and the Assembly in particular this week is there's a focus on the way they put it is really just protecting what they have put into place over the last 8 years. So I think they're expecting to see efforts to change some policies that they've put into place, and they'll be holding the line on those. But, you know, transportation, healthcare, education, those are the issues that really dominated the campaign, and those are the issues that I think we're hearing legislators talk about, whether it's opportunities to work across the aisle or areas where they may face some disagreement.
Well, Robin Voss will still be the Speaker of the State Assembly. He and Governor Walker didn't agree on transportation. Do you think that the Speaker will be able to find a bit, maybe even a bit more agreement with Tony Evers' government, on at least on transportation?
Yeah, I think that's really a possibility, and I think that's something that really even Governor-elect Evers brought up on the campaign trail a little bit, is some of the things that you heard about transportation funding from both Governor-elect Evers and from Speaker Voss during the last transportation funding debate, they weren't all that different from each other. They both have sort of come to this with the idea that all options are on the table, that you know, the state may need to look at ways to raise revenue, and that could include a gas tax increase, that could include vehicle registration fee changes, that could include tolling. And those conversations have continued to be had and have faced some roadblocks from people have taken harder line stances on some things. Governor Walker in particular has said absolutely no increase to the gas tax or to registration fees without a corresponding decrease somewhere else. And in fact, has gone a little further than that sometimes and has said just absolutely no increase, even if there is a decrease somewhere. So I think, you know, Governor-elect Evers has said he sees an opportunity there. He said transportation is an area. He said people want a bipartisan win is something that he said repeatedly on the campaign trail, and I think transportation is an area that he sees a lot of opportunity to work across the aisle on.
Well, let's turn to Assembly Democrats. Who's going to serve? We know Gordon Hintz will be the minority leader. Who will be the assistant minority leader?
The assistant minority leader will be Diane Hasselbein from Middleton. She did have a challenge from David Crowley from Milwaukee, but she was reelected to that spot. So some familiar faces coming back to the Assembly Democratic leadership team, too.
There, and as you mentioned, there was a you mentioned the challenge for assistant minority leader. We understand Representative Crowley said his campaign for the role wasn't a referendum on the current assistant minority leader, but it was about diversity. What was he talking about there?
Sure. I mean, he was talking about the fact, sort of twofold. One, the Assembly Democratic leadership team does not include any person of color. So David Crowley is an African-American legislator, and he said, you know, this is not a knock on anything that Diane Hasselbein has done, and it's certainly important to have gender diversity, too, but that they need to look at having racial diversity in their leadership ranks, and also just having a voice from Milwaukee. He said, you know, he wants he represents a district in Milwaukee. He said he wants his constituents in Milwaukee to know that they have skin in the game, and to see someone fighting for them in leadership role in the Democratic caucus.
Let's take a call. Cindy is joining us from Appleton. Cindy, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Well, Robin Voss said the other day that the voters did not send a referendum or a message, but I beg to differ. I think they sent a clear message that we've had enough of the divisiveness and the games, and that it's time to work together as a legislature because we need to get things done here. I mean, the only people that are getting hurt are we, the people.
Cindy, thanks for that. Cindy's comment, Robin Voss saying the voters didn't send a message, I guess, did they or didn't they, do you think?
Well, I think what Robin Voss was indicating by that was that Tony Evers doesn't have a strong mandate because he won by such a small margin and because Republicans maintain control of the legislature. But I think, the overlying theme here is probably that voters did send a bit of a message, and that is that regardless of how it's going to work, divided government may be the way to go because it may require people to make some compromises and find some creative solutions to get things done. I do think it, yes, people are certainly tired of chaos and frustration and divisiveness, and I think this will require people to find some sort of creative ways to try to get things done.
Have Assembly Republicans said anything about how they'll work with colleagues and leaders on the other side of the aisle? I mean, aside from possibly taking votes to limit the governor's power?
We haven't had a lot of conversations coming through about what will happen beyond this first set of extraordinary sessions. There's going to be some conversation later today, in fact, about what to do with this Kimberly-Clark legislation that's kind of been tossed around over the last few months. So that incentive package will come up. That is something that, if it is going to pass, is going to need votes from both parties, and it's not clear that that will happen. It doesn't sound like any Democrats in the Senate are willing to support that, and there aren't a majority of Republicans in the Senate that will support it either. So that's an area where, if it's going to move forward, it's going to require some bipartisan support. As you mentioned, this next extraordinary session after that, it sounds like they will be looking at ways to curb the governor's power, and there hasn't been any concrete releases on what measures they're going to take in that regard, but that's something that I think is going to be a contentious conversation. Certainly Democrats are promising to stand firm against those efforts, and there hasn't been a whole lot of conversation yet about what the priorities will be for the regular legislative session when they come back in January.
Well, of course, Tony Evers will have the responsibility for putting together a budget and sending it to the legislature. And that's probably where the fireworks are going to start. Let's take a quick call from Tom in Burlington. Tom, good morning.
I would like to see them restore the food stamp program. It's a federal program. The money comes from the federal government. And I would also like to see Robin Voss. I'm in his district. We've had 5 deaths in his district. And marijuana should be decriminalized. The connection between opioids and marijuana, it's been shown, and it has to be taken care of. And he's my representative, and I want him to take care of it.
Okay, Tom, thanks for that. So what issues are people telling the legislature they want to see dealt with here other than transportation?
Well, bringing up the issue of marijuana decriminalization is certainly something that with a lot of voters on referendums throughout the state voted to say that this is something that they want legislators to look at. Varying degrees of that, whether it's for medicinal use, recreational use, decriminalization, or legalization. But voters and communities throughout the state did vote in referendums to tell legislators to look at that. And that's something that Tony Evers has said. He supports medical marijuana, but is waiting to see what voters have to say about recreational usage. So, that's a conversation that continues to come back, and some Republican legislators have started to show some interest, but it's traditionally been something that hasn't gotten much Republican support. I think looking beyond that and looking at the opioid issue, which the caller also mentioned, that is an area where the legislature has found ways to work together over the last several years.
And one thing we know for sure, Jesse O'Poyen, is that you're going to be very busy writing about all of this, and we look forward to reading it. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse O'Poyen covers state government and politics for the Cap Times. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.